to NBC Sports Pro Basketball Talk Podcast. Brett Pollock off here with Kurt Heelan. What is going on, Kurt?
Not much. I am ready for a fun weekend of, there's going to be some great basketball, some game sixes. I think we're definitely going to see a couple game sevens. And then, hey, you have the Kentucky Derby to throw in, too.
Yeah, exactly. Plenty going on. I know our NBC network is super excited about that Derby event for sure.
I throw a party every year. I'll be watching. I'm a big Derby fan. So
nice. Well, we got at least one Game 7 if things don't bounce the right way for the rest of the series. But let's get right into it. We'll go ahead and go around the league with all the series going on here. Wanted to start with the Celtics and the Knicks because New York really should have closed out this series, if not in Boston in Game 5, certainly, or in Game 4, certainly in New York in Game 5. But there was a lot of nonsense from that team heading into it for a team that hadn't really been there before. They really sort of took the Celtics a little too lightly and didn't seem very mentally prepared for that game.
No, they didn't. And they've fallen into just absolutely terrible habits on offense. I mean, this was a team that actually, you know, during their win streak, during the regular season, did such a nice job moving the ball. And now, I mean, if you saw the numbers, they averaged 15 isolations a game during the regular season, which is still like, I mean, the league average was closer to 10. I mean, it's already a lot. They're at 26 a game. And when you isolate against the Celtics on that overload defense of theirs, where, you know, everybody's on the strong side, you're going to run into trouble. You're not going to be efficient. And that's exactly what's happening. They're running so much stuff right into what the Celtics want them to do, and they're not moving the ball, and they're not sharing it. And they're going to lose Game 6, and they'll lose Game 7 if they don't start, you know, getting back to what they know how to do.
Well, in those isolation sets, you know, if you miss the jumper, you're pretty much done, right? I mean, you're not going to get offensive rebounds because you're on the strong side of the floor, the Celtics defense. And the Knicks, for better or worse, are mostly a jump-shooting team. It's Carmelo Anthony on the perimeter, J.R. Smith on the perimeter. Sure, Melo will attack at times, and so will J.R., but for the most part, these are guys that like to launch, you know, jumpers or three-pointers. Knicks, one of the better three-point shooting teams in the league, and the shots aren't falling, and it's playing right into the Celtics' hands.
Yeah, that's why they need to get back to some Raymond Felton, Tyson Chandler pick and roll. Heck, even some 4-5, run Carmelo Anthony off the Tyson Chandler pick for a while. But they've got to get something like that where there's motion in the offense and Chandler is rolling. And, you know, they're not going to have Steve Novak, which kind of hurts them to space the floor. He's out again for Game 6. But they've got to find a way to get, you know, to get that action in the middle and then be able to kick it to their open shooters. Because right now the Celtics are contesting everything. And if you watch, the Celtics don't have to move on defense in an isolation set. They come down, they get in their positions, and then, you know, they don't have to shift off. They don't have to do anything. You've got to make any defense, but in particular those defenses, you've got to make them scramble. You've got to make them run. And, you know, it's up to the Knicks. The Knicks are the better team in this series. They are the ones that should have, like you said, they should have won this. They just have to get back to doing what they know how to do.
Well, how much of the Knicks in that last game was just them missing shots? I mean, J.R. Smith started 0 for 10 from the field. He hit a couple threes late to make it a little more respectable, and he did get to the free throw line a little bit. But Carmelo Anthony was brutal, too. He was, you know, he shot 30-something times, made like 11 of them. How much of that was just the Knicks missing shots? Or, you know, like we were talking about, is it a symptom of a bigger problem where they're too stagnant on offense?
Well, I think it's a little more of the latter. I mean, the problem is they're getting contested shots, and there's a, yeah, look, Melo and J.R. Smith are fully capable of knocking those down, but I don't, and they could win, you know, they could win Game 6 just because those guys get hot making contested shots, but they can't live that way. They're not going to beat Indiana in the next round, or Atlanta, but probably Indiana in the next round doing that again. As bad as Indiana's offense is, you know, it's Indiana's a better version of the Celtics, essentially. Really strong on defense, like to pound you inside, have a couple guys that can score but don't generate a lot of offense. But they're essentially a better version of this same team. If you can't manhandle the Celtics, you're going to find trouble with the Pacers.
Well, and as we look at this Game 6 back in Boston, you know, how much of the momentum has shifted to Boston? And, you know, sort of can they get away with playing, you know, their veteran guys so many minutes? I mean, Paul Pierce, I think, was around 44 minutes. Garnett had a heavy load as well, not quite that many. I think he was under 40. But, you know, you're playing these veteran guys a lot of minutes. You're asking a lot of Paul Pierce. Can that be sustained at least for one more game at home in Boston?
I think for the short term, it's okay. I think if that extends out, you start to see the wear and tear. But I think the other thing you get with them coming home to Boston is it's the role guys that are always tend to be better at home and more comfortable in front of the home fans. You could get a really huge Jason Terry or Jeff Green night again, and that's what they need. I mean, they really are going to they're going to have to score more in this game. But Jeff Green is he's been the X factor all series. He's fully capable of lighting it up. They're going to need at least 20 something out of him to win this game. I think, but at home they can fully get that. I'm not sure they get that in a game 7 in Madison Square Garden.
So what do we think? Do we think the Knicks finally step up and close it out, or do we think the Celtics force a game 7?
I got a gut feeling that there's going to be a game 7 in that series. But I think that one and the Houston one are kind of coin tosses. The Knicks should and could close it out. I'm just not convinced one of those two teams will be playing a game 7.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the Knicks are so much better. Yeah. And I really think a lot of it, that last game was just, they just took the Celtics too lightly, all that funeral nonsense, all the quotes, the days leading up to it, J.R. Smith is like, well, this would have been over if I had played game 4. And then Kenyon Martin with the funeral, and then they all wear black and all that BS, you just can't do that in the playoffs against a veteran team. You got to mentally prepare. You got to treat it, a little bit more professionally. So I think if they sort of mentally come correct, for game 6, I expect the Knicks to close it out. But, again, if they don't, and like you said, if they don't move the ball, we're looking at a game 7.
Yeah. And then, you do, obviously, if you're the Knicks, the problem with a game 7, with any single game, is that there's too much variance. Any one thing can happen, I don't mean just injuries. I mean, you can get Jeff Green is fully capable of carrying a team offensively for a night, and you don't want to go into game 7 where he could do that.
Yeah, no team, especially if you finish second in the Eastern Conference, you don't want to be in a game 7 in the first round. So we'll see. We'll see what they do tonight. All right, well, let's shift to the series no one's really watching. We got the Hawks and the Pacers. You've been on duty for the site for this series. Taking one for the team here. What are you seeing out of this series? And what do we expect from the Hawks coming back home for a game 6?
Yeah, brace yourself. There will be a game 7 in this series.
Oh, great.
Look, I've actually watched every minute of this series, and it's just a strange series because the teams are complete Jekyll and Hyde teams at home and on the road. The games don't look anything like each other. Indiana gets home. They get enough offense. They get in the Hawks don't run. They don't get out and get the easy baskets. They shut Josh Smith down. They look like a great team. David West gets his points. They made some great adjustments in Game 5. The first adjustment of the series was that the Hawks, it sounds strange, but they went with Johan Petro at center. And you're like, why would that work? Because it forced Al Horford to his natural 4 position, puts Josh Smith at the 3, and he was a real problem for Paul George. Well, in Game 5, the Hawks finally, the Pacers adjusted back. They started running they put the ball in Paul George's hands and ran him off high pick and rolls. Josh Smith, as a 4, really doesn't defend the ball handler on the pick and roll ever. He didn't quite know how to handle that. George was getting good looks and setting up his teammates, and things opened up. But now we go back to Atlanta for game 6, and I'm positive that you are going to see the Hawks own this game. And the Pacers are just a much more meek team on the road for whatever reason. So in theory, the Pacers should win this. They could win this. If they play like they're capable, they would win this. But I expect there's going to be a Game 7 back in Indiana because the Hawks will play much better and the Pacers will just play much worse. By the way, the stat of this series, by the way, every game in this series won by the home team and won by at least 11 points. For a 3-2 series, it's not been close games at all. Every game has been well in hand.
So, people like to talk up this Pacers team as being like, a semi-threat in the Eastern Conference, but based on what we've seen in this first round with the way that they can't control anything on the road against a Hawks team that's really been mediocre all season long, hasn't really shown flashes of being dominant at all. Once Indiana gets past Atlanta, as we expect in this series, whether it's in 6 or 7, are they a problem in the next round, or is the fact that when they go on the road they lose all control going to be too much for them?
Yeah, I don't think that would have probably picked the Knicks anyway, but again, I think that becomes a strange series where, that's strength on strength. It's the Celtics, like I said, they are a better version of the Celtics. If the Knicks keep playing isolation basketball, they could lose that series, but if they're moving the ball and doing what they can do, they're just going to outscore the Pacers. The Pacers don't, and the Knicks played, especially in the first couple of games of that series, they can play good defense. They just don't do it consistently. You don't have to play a ton of defense against the Pacers. They really lack offensive options. You know, they have David West, who's as good a pick and pop big as there is in the league, and Paul George has clearly had a big year. George Hill is a nice player. I mean, that's a good player, but they lack the creative spark offensively that they really need to be dangerous. And I don't know what they, you know, I feel the Knicks should win that series in the next round, but the Pacers are, any team that can defend is always a little bit dangerous, and those are just two teams that haven't looked consistent at all. So I feel weird trying to, you know, like which team will come out on top and how will it go? I don't know which team's going to show up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's definitely more Pacers-Hawks analysis than you're going to find anywhere else. So, you know, excellent work there on that. Let's look at the last series here in the Eastern Conference, still going on. We got the Bulls and the Nets, and Chicago really didn't have any of its players last night. They were super injured. I mean, Luol Deng out. Everybody else, you know, seemingly limited with one thing or another. Nate Robinson's throwing up on the bench during timeouts. I mean, that team just ravaged by illness and injury, and yet it's a 3-point game, and they had plenty of chances down the stretch with shots, you know, to take the lead or you know, possibly even close the Nets out. What do we expect from that series in a Game 7?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, all series I've been waiting for, you know, Charles Barkley after the game was saying that the Nets don't play with passion. I don't know that it's that so much as they're just not a tough team. They're not a gritty team. They're not a physical team. And they seem really thrown off by that when the Bulls are flowing in their game. And the Bulls, you know, they should have Deng back. You know, they should have Robinson back for Game 7 on Saturday. So, and I think ultimately that's kind of the key. You know what the Bulls are going to do. Like, the question is, A, do they get Kirk Heinrich back, and how much of Kirk Heinrich do they get back? If they can't contain Deron Williams at home, the Nets should win this pretty handily. But the Nets were outplaying them last night and could never pull away. And that's the way the last couple of games have gone. The Nets are clearly the better team, but they can't pull away, and they can't pull away. And if you let the Bulls hang around, Nate Robinson can happen. You know, Luol Deng can happen for a stretch, and they'll put together a little run and beat you. They're going to, you know, the Bulls are like their coach, man. They're pit bulls. They're going to fight you the entire way. They are not going to give up. And the Nets aren't showing the ability to put them away, and they're going to have to now. You know, I mean, they've got the advantage on their home court. They're the better team. They should be able to do this, but I'm not convinced that they will. I mean, I'd say 75-80% chance the Nets win that game, but with these Bulls, and especially with, you know, like I said, Nate Robinson can win you a game by just being Nate Robinson some days. So I mean, the Bulls have a shot.
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen that in the series where Nate Robinson goes off. He, you know, goes for 23 points in the fourth quarter, and then you're in pretty big trouble. You know, what's interesting about the Bulls, they're almost the Spurs version in the Eastern Conference in terms of what they do on the defensive end of the floor. I mean, in San Antonio this season, we saw when they're without Tim Duncan, when they're without Tony Parker, when they're without whoever, they still, it's a system. They still find a way to score the basketball. They still find a way to, you know, get easy shots, and they still pretty much score on par with what they do the whole season. The Bulls are like that defensively. It doesn't really matter who plays. The rotations are taught. The system is in place. The effort is there. And then we see them do what they did last night. They're missing everybody. They're dying on the sidelines in timeouts. And yet it's still a 3-point game late. So I think as long as the Bulls bring that defensive intensity, if they can just get one or two guys back for Game 7, I don't think it matters that it's on the Nets home floor. I mean, I would actually expect Chicago to win that game just based on what we've seen this series.
Yeah, like I said, Deron Williams can be the best player on the floor, but he's got to get some help, and they've just – I mean, it's weird to call a team with Reggie Evans not tough, but they're just not showing that kind of grit that they're going to have to find in this series. You know, I mean, honestly, I would think that Miami, not that, it, frankly, neither of these teams matches up terribly well with Miami right now, but I would think the Miami would look at this and think, if we get the Nets, that could be another 4-game sweep. I mean, they're going to overwhelm the Nets. At least you know the Bulls will fight.
Yeah, the Heat are just basically just sitting back. I mean, either one of these teams, again, the Bulls play tough defense, and they, you know, they ended the Heat's, you know, 27-game winning streak earlier this season. But, you know, unless they're at full strength, they're not really going to be a match for Miami in the playoffs when they're dialed in and looking to win. So, yeah, that game's
it. And Dwayne Wade, with his bum knee, you know, knee bruise he's trying to get over, will have had by Monday, when that series will start on Monday in Miami, whoever it is. That's 12 days off between games. That's, you know, for a guy trying to get healthy, that's huge. And if they get Dwayne Wade back healthy, that's, you know, they just became even tougher.
All right, well, shifting to the Western Conference here, a couple game sixes on deck tonight. Let's start in Houston with the Rockets and the Thunder. Obviously, the Thunder without Russell Westbrook are a very different team. No time to adjust. You know, unfortunately, his injury occurred in the playoffs. You know, had it happened with 10 games left in the regular season, maybe that gives OKC a chance to tweak some lineups and to put some things in and to adjust a little bit. No time to adjust in the playoffs, and we're seeing that the Rockets and the style that they play are causing all sorts of problems for the Thunder. Do we think that the Rockets are able to force a game seven?
I kind of think so. I mean, to me, a lot of this actually, tell me if you see it this way. There's actually more pressure on Scott Brooks than anyone else right now.
Sure.
Because it can't just be all Kevin Durant. He has got to come up with a scheme I'm not even worried about Durant. He's got to find a way to get other guys' buckets. He's got to get Kevin Martin going. And then part of that's on Martin, who's just shot terribly last game. But they have got to get the other guys going. It can't – you in the playoffs, even the Rockets and the Rockets' defense, which isn't certainly formidable, they are going to shut down your first option. If not shut down, they're going to make it so that he's not efficient. They can make Kevin Durant have to work really hard for all his points. And the way you have to win in the playoffs is with your second and third and fourth option. Well, let's see it. With Westbrook gone, they haven't had it, and they've got to find it. Or I think they're, you know, I think this is the one really could go to a game seven, out of the West, because at home the Rockets will be better and faster. I mean, Chandler Parsons has been amazing this series. I think he's been really amazing all year. I think a lot of people are just noticing now how great he's been.
Right.
James Harden will have a big game if they can get a couple of role players to step up. I think that they can force, unless Scott Brooks has a trick, unless he's found a way to get other guys going. Again, this is the Thunder are the better team, but they're still trying to figure out who they are without Westbrook.
Yeah, and actually OKC's problems have been even bigger on the defensive end than on offense. I mean, yeah, they need to find other guys besides Durant, you know, to be reliable scorers. Kevin Martin hasn't been a reliable scorer all season long. You know, he's had his moments, but you know, he hasn't been a guy where you can count on 24 points a game from him or anything like that. The Thunder's defense has been atrocious. I mean, they've let Houston do whatever they want offensively. And it's actually kind of funny to watch the Rockets if you know what they're trying to do, which is they play the percentages on offense. Almost all their shots, I'd say 90%+ of their shot attempts are either at the rim or behind the three-point line. They don't want mid-range jumpers, and once you know that's what they're trying to do, and if you watch the game, it's actually hilarious because that's the only shots that that team will take, and they'll move the ball or they'll dribble penetrate until they get either to the rim or back out. But the Thunder just need to be aware of that those are the two shots that Houston's looking to take. I don't know how they shore that up defensively. James Harden is extremely tough to deal with, as they know, you know, better than anybody, considering he was on that team that went to the finals last year. You know, I expect the Rockets to do what they do, you know, to score the ball and to continue to cause problems for this Thunder team. You know, all they need to do is hit some threes at home, get Harden going like they do, and I think we're looking at a game seven. And, you know, unless the Thunder can shore up things on the defensive end of the floor, you know, they're going to be in some trouble this series.
I think you're spot on there. I think it's more likely to go to a game seven, but I really think the questions aren't about Houston. Like, we know what Houston is. We know what they're going to try to do. It's what can Oklahoma City do without Westbrook to stop it?
Well, and let's not forget that, you know, the Rockets have been without Jeremy Lin the last couple games, and they've gotten just amazing production from Patrick Beverley, who's obviously public enemy number one in Oklahoma City. But, you know, he shouldn't be. That whole thing is ridiculous. You know, the Thunder players shouldn't be going after him. The Thunder fans shouldn't be booing the guy. Everybody has said, including Kevin Durant, including the Thunder players, wasn't a dirty play. If you watch basketball during the regular season, it happens every single night where players try to go for a steal into a timeout. You know, yeah. The fact that they're just, you know, putting that guy up as some sort of like dirty player or villain is totally ridiculous.
Exactly. Look, in fact, we've seen the video of Westbrook making sort of similar plays and going after people. You know, he's a gnat. I mean, Patrick Beverley is in the league because he gets under your skin. I mean, he's there because he plays that hard all the time. It certainly wasn't an intentional shot at the knee. I think he was going for the ball, didn't get it, you know, and moved on, and it was just kind of a fluke thing.
Exactly. All right, well, looking at the other game six that we have tonight, we got the Clippers going to Memphis, and, you know, talking about funerals, this certainly looks to be one for the Clippers. Blake Griffin was limited last game, unfortunately suffered a sprained ankle in practice before game five and, you know, was only able to be out there for about 19 minutes. What was crazy was how aggressive he was in the early parts of that game. He was just, people that don't like the Clippers would say he was kind of flopping and flailing all over the place. You know, that's sort of the criticism of Blake Griffin if you're not a fan of his game. He's game time decision. We expect him to try to play, but, you know, if he's limited once again or if he, you know, can't play the whole game, you know, what do the Clippers need to do to try to force a game seven here?
Yeah, that's their problem. They have to find a way to stop Zach Randolph right now and Marc Gasol, and that means, you know, a healthy enough Blake Griffin to give them points. Lamar Odom will be Lamar Odom. I mean, he'll be fine. And the other part of that is, you know, you're counting on a whole lot of good DeAndre Jordan, and you know,
yeah, that's not going to happen.
I don't think you can count on two quarters of good DeAndre Jordan. This is a tough, tough spot for them. I mean, Chris Paul's going to play as well as he can play, but they're going to need a monster game. I think, you know, the guy for the Clippers who's really going to have to step up, you're going to need a huge night out of Matt Barnes because they may even go small. They may try to play him at the four at stretches to try to just make it a more up-tempo, chaotic, go small against the bigs type of system, because what else have they got to do? If Blake Griffin can't be effective, they've got to come up with something else. That they don't have other effective bigs, and that's their problem right now. Is that Blake Griffin may have been the only effective big they had, and now he's not right. I think maybe they go small. Maybe they try to run the Grizzlies out of the building, but I don't think that's going to work too well. In fact, the Grizzlies they strangely like that kind of chaotic game. For a team that's kind of a slow-down, grinding team, if you want to make it chaotic, they will pick you apart in that style of play. So this is the one I think, if there's one game I was going to say was a lock not to go seven out of the four on Friday night, I think that this is it. I think the Grizzlies are going to be able to handle this. It won't be easy because Chris Paul's Chris Paul, and he'll have a huge night. But at the end of the day, I just think the Grizzlies are going to win this one, you know, by 10 or 12 and cruise in pretty comfortably. And they've got to be pumped. I mean, wouldn't you be pumped right now if you were looking ahead saying, we win this game, then we get Oklahoma City next?
Yeah, or Houston.
Exactly. Either way, suddenly you're looking at the conference finals, and last time Memphis went up against San Antonio, that worked out pretty well for them.
Yeah, I just think, you know, Memphis has really impressed me with the amount of adjustments they've made in the series. They've really pushed all the right buttons since those first two games. You know, they had Zach Randolph especially couldn't stay on the floor in those first two games in L.A. He was struggling through foul trouble. And then when the Clippers went to that smaller, more athletic lineup, you know, Hollins ended up sitting him late in those games. But, you know, Randolph has really been just a dominant force. You know, since then, the Clippers have tried these three-guard lineups with Chris Paul, Eric Bledsoe, and Jamal Crawford. And, you know, Memphis has been able to handle that. They put length on Chris Paul with either, you know, Tony Allen or Tayshaun Prince at times. They've shifted Allen onto Crawford. And after those couple early games in L.A., Crawford hasn't done much, you know, in this series. And, you know, one of the other things that I noticed in Game 5 back in Los Angeles, the Grizzlies made sure that their bigs were not going to get into any early foul trouble. If you watch the first two quarters of that game, every time the ball came inside, they stood there as if they had four fouls already in the first quarter. They just stood straight up, hands up. You know, that's a coaching adjustment to you know, make sure your players are aware, hey, you can't pick up cheap fouls in the first quarter because it throws off the rotations, gets the Clippers going early, and then we're struggling to play catch up the rest of the game. So I've just been real impressed with the way that the Grizzlies have adjusted throughout this series. It's going to be extremely tough. You know, you're looking at role players like Matt Barnes. Matt Barnes, actually, this has been one of Matt Barnes' better seasons, you know, in his career. So, you know, we might see still another good game out of him. Eric Bledsoe has not been good on the road. He kind of gets a little bit of sort of an irrational amount of love from people that follow the Clippers because he's so exciting in small spurts. But if you look at, you know, his sort of body of work, he's sketchy to have out there, you know, for extended minutes, especially on the road. I just think it's a real tough spot. I mean, Chris Paul put up a ton of points in Game 5, and it wasn't enough. I don't see how the Clippers, you know, all of a sudden magically, you know, turn it on for Game 6.
And I got a great question out of PBT Extra yesterday from Kay Adams. I'll throw this one at you. Let's say Clippers lose Game 6, Grizzlies win in advance. Which team has more turnover this summer, the Clippers or the Lakers?
It's got to be the Clippers. I mean, the Lakers have some sort of built-in turnover. We don't know what's happening with Dwight Howard, although, you know, we expect him to be back. They're probably going to do something with Gasol, which I'm totally against because I think he's a championship player. And, you know, as soon as he's traded to whoever for a bag of basketballs, you know, he's going to be back in the All-Star game next season. So that's just going to – it's going to automatically look like a dumb trade. You know, we already know Anton Jameson's probably not coming back. So, there's a lot of sort of built-in turnover on that Lakers roster, but none more severe than what we might see with the Clippers. I mean, if the Clippers lose this first-round series, there's no way you can bring Vinny Del Negro back. You know, Chris Paul is an unrestricted free agent. We don't necessarily expect him to leave. But, you know, Clippers ownership and management, you know, hasn't exactly been impressive ever. So what would make him believe that they would be able to put together a championship contender around him? Then he'd have to deal with a new head coach, which anytime, you know, you can always say, okay, Vinny Del Negro's not the guy, fire him. Well, who are you bringing in? And who is that person going to be? And how is he going to fit with Chris Paul and his personality? You know, a lot of questions. I would say the Clippers are going to be in a lot more trouble this summer, especially because I don't trust their management. I trust Mitch Kupchak with the Lakers. I don't trust the Clippers, you know, front office to necessarily make the right decisions or do the right thing, especially when dealing with the Chris Paul and the, you know, the sort of necessary coaching change that's on the horizon.
Yeah, well, I think what you'd see over there is, yeah, I think Vinny's on, but I think Chris Paul essentially gets to pick the new coach, and that can be good or bad, but I think the pieces are there. I mean, Griffin can be a good number two. They've got to find somebody who can get them to defend, and either I think with them, it's come to the DeAndre Jordan, you know, are you going to Fisher cut bait? Do you think you can get him to defend and be consistent? Because, I mean, there's moments where he's great and games where he's great, but you can't get him to do it consistently. Are you better off at trying to trade him, like letting him be somebody else's problem and see what you get back and rebuild around different guys? I know Clippers management isn't ready to give up on DeAndre Jordan, and that was a big battle at the trade deadline. Because, you know, remember right. All those calls to about the Celtics, and, you know, would they be open to a Kevin Garnett, DeAndre Jordan type deal? I'm not sure Boston would have done that, but that was all Vinny Del Negro making calls. That wasn't Clipper front office people. They are much more in tune with keeping DeAndre and trying to go that route, or at least they were before this series. And I'm curious now that they've seen the playoffs again and everything, if they're as committed to keeping DeAndre Jordan around.
Well, all season long, DeAndre's sort of been a problem, right? I mean, in terms of not giving the Clippers exactly, you know, what they need, you know, from a starting big man like that, he hasn't been able to stay on the floor late in games. And all season, when you ask Vinny Del Negro, hey, what does DeAndre need to do to stay on the floor in the fourth quarter, he always put it back on DeAndre. I think the Clippers need a little bit more player development, you know, where he's concerned. So, you know, if they're willing to invest in his development and look in big picture, you know, I think you give it another season, maybe bring in, you know, I have no idea who's on the Clippers, you know, coaching staff in terms of player development or if they're any good at all, but you definitely need to give him another year to develop. I think, you know, he has the tools, he's young, he's athletic, he's big, but, you know, you need to teach the guy, you know, you need to develop him a little bit. So if the organization's willing to do that, that's fine. If not, if they're like, you know, we need to improve immediately and we want to start going deep into the playoffs instead of, you know, this first round nonsense. I mean, essentially last season, they beat the Grizzlies in 7 games, but then they were swept in the second round. So it's the same thing. You know, it's a couple more home games for revenue, but that's about it. I would like to see the Clippers. They're definitely going to have to get rid of Del Negro. You know, who else is out there? You know, Chris Paul came to LA because he wanted the big market. So that's going to be a huge thing in terms of whether or not he decides to leave. You know, he's probably back just like Dwight Howard's back with the Lakers, but in terms of what the Clippers are going to do beyond that, it's tough to see at this point.
Yeah, and you come back to owners and management with the Clippers making decisions. Look at it this way: if Vinny Del Negro is partially there because he's affordable, like he's not the expensive end of the coaching spectrum, if you're going to contend, if you're going to dump Vinny and say, I've got to bring in a guy who can get us to contend, you either have to do one of two things. You have to find the next Tom Thibodeau, who you can get cheap for a few years and is just spectacular as a coach and nobody gave him a chance yet. That's a big risk. Or you got to spend and go get a Stan Van Gundy type. It doesn't necessarily, you know, maybe it's Nate McMillan. It doesn't have to be Stan. A, with the Clippers ownership, would Donald Sterling fork over the kind of money it's going to take to bring in that expensive a coach? And B, Stan Van Gundy doesn't walk through that door. Nate McMillan doesn't walk through that door without some say over player and personnel decisions. And are they willing to make that move too? I mean, that comes back to what their front office is willing to pay and willing to do.
Well, will definitely be an interesting summer for the Clippers. Let's shift to the 1 second round series that's actually set in stone here. The Warriors got a big win at home Thursday night over the Nuggets, so Nuggets are eliminated from the playoffs. Sets up a second round series with the San Antonio Spurs. What are your thoughts on that series? Sort of a brief preview. What are we looking to see out of that Spurs Warriors series?
The Warriors are going to win a game because they'll shoot their way through a game, but I think their little magical run will be ending. This too disciplined a team in the Spurs to and now rested, with a healthy Tony Parker to fall to them. The other problem there is this has just been a house of horrors for Golden State. The last time they won in San Antonio was this about the same time, honestly, about the same time Steve Jobs returned to Apple. It was that long ago. It was 97 was the last time the Warriors won in San Antonio. That speaks to franchise futility and where those franchises are, but I think it also speaks to that this is just a bad matchup for them, I think, in terms of – it's what they want to be eventually in terms of that, but I just don't – the discipline and the system that the Spurs run is going to just wear the Warriors down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way the Spurs let Stephen Curry drop 30-something points on three-point shots, right? I mean, they're just not going to allow that. They're going to make the Warriors' other guys beat them, and, it's going to be tough. You know, what's interesting is they split the regular season series 2-2, but just like every team against the Spurs weren't 100%. Tim Duncan missed a game. Parker and Ginobili missed two of those games. Stephen Curry actually missed one of those games for the Warriors. But, you know, so two wins against the Spurs in the regular season doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot now that they're at full strength for the playoffs.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of the using regular season games as postseason predictors. It tends to go really poorly only because, I mean, and we put it in our previews, but I think you have to be really careful reading into that because you second game of back-to-backs or in the middle of four games in five nights or, you know, like you're talking about who played and didn't play because of injuries. And also, look, if your team's played in January, both of these teams and frankly every team left in the playoffs is a different team than they were in January. It's not apples to apples.
Well, and then, you know, just sort of one other thing, if the Warriors are thinking maybe like, not the Warriors, the team, but if their fans are thinking like, well, hey, you know, David Lee made a brief appearance, last night, maybe we'll get him back against the Spurs and we'll have a chance. It's not going to happen. Lee told reporters last night, there's zero chance of him playing anywhere near like 30 minutes or something. He just wanted to kind of come out there, see what he could do. But once he missed that jump shot and backpedaled, he essentially said he had no legs. So yeah. You may get Lee for a few minutes here or there if he feels like he can go. But that was more of an emotional thing than anything else. We don't expect him, and he doesn't expect to be able to be productive in this series.
Yeah, it was a nice Willis Reed moment. But sure. That's kind of all it was. And by the way, Willis Reed hit some shots.
Lee said that after. He said, like, hey, Reed hit his jumper, so.
Yeah. And the other part of that is, if you didn't see this, Andrew Bogut got shots in his ankle before Game 6, pain-killing shots, a sign that he's not all the way back. And that's, I mean, it's that front line. The Spurs have somebody pretty good on their front line. I forget his name. Tim something.
Yeah, he's been around for a while. I kind of forget, too. Yeah, I forget him, too. He's been around for a while, but I don't know. The name just doesn't stick.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this week. Make sure to leave us some comments. Let us know how we're doing. And Kurt, look forward to speaking with you next time.
Talk to you then.